Hi, I'm Mike Dilk and you're listening to the Relax Back UK show, the show that explores all kinds of health topics relevant to you, your family and your friends. Each week I talk to expert guests from a range of backgrounds to inform and entertain you. So please do join the Relax Back UK family and stay tuned.
Hi, and thank you for joining me on the Relax Back UK show this week. The first guest is Suki Banger, who is a type 2 diabetes specialist nurse, and we talk about tech in relation to health and specifically type 2 diabetes.
Nearly 50% of those living with diabetes that are disengaged from technology, and that really does worry me.
Then a massive looming issue in health.
Well, if you're not taking the full course, then the bacterial infection isn't being treated properly, which then gives it more room to start building resistance. So it's super important if we're trying to keep the effectiveness of antibiotics through this campaign and through, you know, up until years to come, then it's really important to finish your course of antibiotics.
The issue is, will antibiotics continue to work? My guests for this are Alice Tai, OBE, swimming Paralympian, and Matt Dawson, MBE, ex-England rugby scrum half. So please stay tuned for a great show. Thank you.
This show is cool!
I first asked Suki Banger, diabetic specialist nurse, for a recap on what type 2 diabetes is and who might get it.
Thanks, Mike. Really lovely to be here and thank you. So, yeah, let's just keep the type 2 diabetes definition top line. So as a diabetes specialist nurse, when I try and explain to the people in with type 2 diabetes on why have I got this condition, a lot of them think to themselves, well, actually, it's my fault. Have I eaten too much? Am I overweight? You know, it's in regards to your blood glucose levels starting to elevate. And a lot of people don't know they've got type 2 diabetes. So they're walking around with elevated glucose levels. They don't even know that they have type 2 diabetes until such time, you know, something happens. They start getting symptoms. For example, they're going to the toilet a lot. They may be losing a bit of weight. And then they need to go and see their healthcare professionals like their GP to have a blood test done, which then tells us that the glucose levels via a blood test are over a certain level. And this is via a HbA1c. And this HbA1c is essentially about the accumulation of your red blood cells over 3 months. And all that glucose sticks to those red blood cells. So everything we basically consume sticks to the red blood cells and you get a level. So it tends to be at diagnosis, you'd normally get about two levels at 48 millimoles per mole or above, which then gives you that diagnosis of type 2 diabetes. Or there'll be another particular blood test, for example.
You mentioned some units there. Give me those units again, because I like when people talk about numbers, they add units to them. So these
are millimoles per mole. So it'd be your HbA1c. And if you want me to go back into a little bit more of a dynamic, it's called glycated hemoglobin. So it's like a sugared red blood cell. But, you know, when I do feel that when somebody does get this diagnosis, they feel it can be a life sentence. And what can we do as clinicians, or what can we do as a patient to support each other?
Yeah, well, I'm going to ask you a lot about that, specifically also about how tech can help with it. But I'd be quite keen to just talk about health and tech a little bit in general. Have you heard of, do you know a comedian, Miles Jupp? He's a very funny guy, and he was on a BBC kind of a program. It was a quiz program, and he invented a new word, and I really like this word. Okay, the word he invented is app nauseam, and I am definitely a sufferer, because I need an app to park my car. I need an app to get 10% off at Wix. I even need an app to buy dog food and get my car serviced. So, enough. I've had enough of apps, and I'm sure quite a few people are suffering from app nauseam. So do you detect a general kind of pushback a little bit on tech? I suppose that's in relation to your world, which is, you know, health.
Yeah, and I think if we look at the word technology and you refer it back to sort of 10 years ago, we weren't so, the pace that technology has moved from 10 years ago is phenomenal, and we are driving. So, and we think about the disengagement, and you're right, it's probably going to be the younger population that are probably disengaged from technologies, as are, well, as is everybody. But if we look at the stats, we can say that from Abbott's research, so there is new Abbott research to suggest that over a third, 35% of adults are disengaged from technology, don't want to talk about it. Exactly what you've just said, you know, need an app for this, need an app for that, and therefore I just want to disconnect. But what's more worrying is that you then look at the health conditions, chronic health conditions like type 2 diabetes, you've got nearly 50% of those living with diabetes that are disengaged from technology. And that really does worry me a little bit, because
I can imagine that. I mean, just health and technology. I had a whole list of kind of negative things. So I thought, right, I better think of some things that are really positive. So I thought about me, talking about me and where I found that tech really helps as far as health is concerned. And there's some really positive things, some of them quite simple. So just communicating with the NHS, not via a load of letters that, you know, get lost in the post or lost under the map, all that sort of thing. So actually getting communication with the NHS via, well, electronic communication, that's a really good thing, as I think. And the NHS app is brilliant. I've just dissed apps, but for making appointments and getting repeat prescriptions, all that kind of stuff, really fantastic. That works for me big time. And I'm sure I'm not the only one.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And, you know, technology, like I said, is fast moving, and it's so important in the world of health. Again, we bring it back to type 2 diabetes. So, you know, we have got these studies to now say that we need to think about what we're going to do. So Abbott have launched a new campaign called, it's called the One Step Ahead. So basically the One Step Ahead is basically telling us as a nation, let's spark a conversation. Let's start talking about tech disengagement. Let's talk about the impact it has on health in regards to chronic diseases, more so type 2 diabetes. And let's get people talking. And why are they so disengaged from technology?
Well, I mean, it's easy to amass vast amounts of information. So it's easy, like there's all these things that offer blood tests that you can actually, a lot of them you can do at home. You know, they send you a thing, you stick a little needle into your thumb and get some blood in the thing and send it off in the post. And they'll send you back a list of hundreds of markers showing you this, that, and the next thing. And a lot of people wear exercise watches that just amass vast amounts of data about, you know, blood pressure and how well you've slept and all this kind of stuff. And I've started to think that just having vast amounts of data can actually be a little bit scary, and it might not necessarily really change your habits, because for years, GPs have been telling us to, well, Mike, you really need to lose a little bit of weight, or you need to sort of drink less alcohol. It's just the same thing. It's just another way of being nagged at. And we're quite good at ignoring it, I think.
So, look, I think were we ignoring that already in regards to the letters that we receive, the phone calls that we receive? And again, I bring it back to the world of diabetes, because that is my specialism and I'm upskilling healthcare professionals. So, look, if we give somebody, for example, let's think about type 2 diabetes. What type of technology am I going to give to my patient living with type 2 diabetes? I'm going to offer them something like a CGM, a continuous glucose monitor, that basically measures the glucose levels. Now, that's the world where I would want them to monitor, to say, look, let's give you this technology. It's going to avoid you finger pricking about 8 times a day. The fear factor on finger pricking, and also saying to me, Suki, I don't like it. It's painful. It's a snapshot. It doesn't give me my highs and lows. And also, it doesn't give me something. It only gives me that immediate blood glucose from a blood glucose monitor via finger pricking. Now let's compare it to continuous glucose monitoring. For example, the FreeStyle Libre 2 Plus sensor. What does it do? It gives you confidence. You have glucose levels that are continuous. It enables the individual to have the impactful visual of what's going on in front of them. They can see what's going on. And I always say, there's something I utilize in regards to, I say to my person living with diabetes, it makes the invisible visible. Now, I've got family members living with type 1 diabetes, and my particular family member who was not monitoring, and now he has a CGM. It's changed his world completely. He's able to monitor. He's got confidence, and he's got a better relationship with his healthcare professional as well.
So tell me, this CGM, continuous glucose monitor. So this is a device.
Yes.
Right. So, right. Well, how big is it and where does it go? and how do you kind of, so presumably you've got to stick it into yourself somehow. Tell me all the basics.
I love how you said that. Just for everybody listening, we don't stick it into ourselves. Now, so what we do is, it's basically a little sensor that sits in the back of the arm. And
you say so little, you place, how little? Give how
it's,
big?
I would say it's about a 2p, 2 pence piece.
Okay. And what, the same thickness?
Yes, a couple of millimeters.
Okay.
So basically it sits there and it's there for about, it's 15 days. So it monitors the individual's glucose levels for 15 days.
How is it attached?
So it's got an adhesive. So basically there's a mechanism, two parts to it. You basically put it together. You pop at the back of the arm, and while we can see each other, you pop at the back of the arm and it continues.
You've got one. You're a user.
I've got one on at the moment, and I just basically pop it on there for educational purposes.
All right.
And it really does bring back home as to what I didn't realize. So I didn't realize that perhaps that naan bread that I'm eating was going to elevate my glucose levels, because the conversations I have with individuals living with type 2 diabetes, well, Suki, I don't eat any sugar. I don't eat biscuits, Suki, but I'll have four slices of bread and I'll do this and I'll do that. And I say, well, let's come back. Let's look at your CGM data and let's see how we can change your diet lifestyle. For example, if somebody is on insulin therapy, Mike, what we tend to advocate is trying to get their levels safe. And if they have a low blood glucose level and we look at the data, they'll have a low and then they'll automatically have a high, because that's how you do it. You will treat a low with something sugary. But it's basically looking at why that low happened. And you know what it is a lot of the time? It's that bottle of wine on a Friday night. It will bring those levels down and then you will automatically go up. So we have these conversations to say to the individual what we should improve our areas. But honestly, every single individual that I see, review, family members who have got a CGM, it's changed their life.
Okay.
It's made them feel more positive and confident.
I'm going to ask you a lot more about that, but I've still got some very basic questions. You got this thing about the size of a 2p, and you stick it onto the under of your arm. How does it get the information from your blood? Does it work through the skin or?
So, Mike, basically, it's not basically through the blood. It's called the interstitial fluid. So it's the liquid around the red blood cells. Okay. So that's how it basically gets the levels, and you get the continuous levels from the CGM.
And as accurate as getting a drop of blood from your thumb?
So the accuracy is there. We've got a plethora of research accuracy around CGM. So be rest assured. Obviously, there will be areas, the discussions I will have with individual patients that I see in clinic, to say, we always say have a backup finger prick blood glucose monitor as a backup as well. Just to make sure that they can always check their levels if they don't match their symptoms. So if you have a CGM and it doesn't match the symptoms of what you're seeing, then you want to back it up with a finger prick level, just to make sure that, you know, it's fairly in line and we're okay to move forward. But moving forward, I would say the majority of individuals who are utilizing a FreeStyle Libre 2 sensor don't tend to have many concerns at all.
Okay, so you got this thing on, and where do you actually see the results? After me being so rude about apps, is it another app that you see your results on?
It is. There is an app that they do download. But again, for those who may not be as tech savvy, we also have a reader. So Abbott do provide a reader that they can connect to. So again, it is a bit of a technology, but the simplicity is the way forward. And it's very simple to utilize. And you do get these continuous levels. You get so much information, and we guide the individual on the parts of the information that's going to be very valid for them.
Okay. Does it go one step further, and as well as giving you information, can it send information back to your GP or whoever is kind of looking after you?
Oh, absolutely. So, we talk about digital technology. So when they connect, when they have a sensor, they can connect to the GP practice, who will be connected to what we call Libre View. So it's a platform where we connect the sensor. And there are other platforms out there, but this particular platform, you connect and your healthcare professional has the data in front of you. So that review with the person living with diabetes in your clinic doesn't need to be face to face. It can be via a phone call, it can be via a video call. So it gives that opportunity for the individual to say, Suki, I can't see you today, so therefore, can I do a phone consultation? Absolutely, I've got your data connected. Let's do the phone review.
All right, and that works quite well.
Oh, it works incredibly well.
Okay,
incredibly well.
So if someone's using this and they're getting the results on their phone, on the app. Is there kind of a facility where if something actually starts going bad, dangerously bad, like, okay, you need to stop driving now or whatever it is there a beep, like an alarm?
Yes. So, yeah, for again, I always say, look, there, if you have a situation that you find challenging, for example, if you start to think you're having a low glucose level, then, yeah, absolutely. There's alarm set on the app or your device to basically set up where it will beep, and it will tell you where your glucose levels are going. It's also got an arrow, whether it goes up, it goes down, diagonally and so forth. So it gives you this information to preempt it. So a lot of what I've also seen with technology and type 2 diabetes, they are so much more comfortable, for example, to go to bed at night, not worrying about, am I going to have a low glucose? So therefore, I'm going to run my glucose levels much higher because I'm so fearful. So the app has got the alarm settings absolutely there as well.
Okay. Now, I have heard about this next step, which sounds absolutely fantastic to me. And that is you have a little pump which can give you a dose of insulin when you need it. Now, does this thing hook up to the pump so that, you don't have to be in the loop? You can have one machine talking to another machine to inject your insulin.
So, yes, look, the sensor does partnership with other pump companies. But that will be, that's a different conversation.
Is it? Okay. It sounds like it should be the same conversation to me. It sounds pretty connected.
So, yeah, I mean, if you think about pump, it's more aligned with type 1 diabetes. And we know technology is completely available for type 1 diabetes. And I think it's really difficult for those living with type 2 diabetes and criteria to maybe think about access. So access for type 1, as you've rightly said, many individuals living with type 1 diabetes have got accessibility to a pump and a sensor with what we call a hybrid closed loop system.
Right. But the pump really works for people with type 1 as opposed to type 2?
Yes.
Okay. All right. I hadn't really gathered that. Okay. It does sound, this whole thing sounds like it can make people's lives who are suffering from diabetes in general, I suppose we're talking about type 2 here, much better. This is probably an impossible question, or I don't know. How many people suffer from type 2 diabetes in the UK?
So there's a lot of, I think we've got about 4 million, if I'm correct, who are, type 2 diabetes. And I think the levels are increasing, and I think we look we look at something like technology, could technology dampen that? Can it reduce the amount of individuals? And again, I go back to the Abbott's One Step Ahead campaign, that saying, be curious, start talking, think about what's going on in your body, go and have a conversation with your healthcare professional. Let's try and reduce the amount of diagnoses we are having around type 2 diabetes. But for those who are diagnosed, there is technology available there.
You predict my next question perfectly, because I've never had a novel thought yet, so there's no reason why I should start now. And it was going to be, well, surely it would be better if we use some of this fantastic technology to kind of reduce that 4 million number. And, you know, and it is the perennial problem, isn't it? Because we don't necessarily listen to ourselves or the information, the good advice from our GP, or as it turns out, the advice staring us in the face from all these apps that are driven by our watches and all the rest of it. So is there any hope for us as a species, or are we just all going to get type 2 diabetes? What can we do?
Oh, dear, that's a negative. No, Mike, you
it
know
it is
what?
A bit. Yeah, look, we need to finish on a high here. Help me.
Let's finish on a high. Let's finish on a complete positive look. There's access, and there's access is improving in regards to type 2 diabetes. However, we want to, like you said, we want to try and cascade it out even further. But let's talk about a landmark study that Abbott basically has released. And this is significantly important in regards to what you're saying. So the landmark study is called Freedom 2. So
I like studies. This is a peer-reviewed published study, is it?
It's a published study, and it's a randomized controlled trial.
But not so peer-reviewed. Okay.
I think we can possibly just confirm that.
All right. Okay.
Yes, it is.
So, yeah, there we go. Bill's confirmed it. Thank you. So, yeah. So, yes, Mike, it's definitely a peer-reviewed.
Good. We like that.
And it's a randomized controlled trial. And basically what we're saying about this landmark study is it is allowing us to have that talk about why is everybody on insulin with type 2 diabetes not entitled to a CGM, a continuous glucose monitor. So the population here was roughly about 300 individuals living with type 2 diabetes, and they were basically segmented into about roughly about 200 a sensor, a freestyle Libre sensor, and the other 100 with self-monitor finger prick testing. Now, these individuals were living with type 2 diabetes, and the medications that they were on was a background insulin. So it's just a lovely background insulin that they're on, but they're also on medications like what we call SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1s. Now, these are in regards to the NICE guidelines. So these individuals are a fantastic example of the everyday person living with type 2 diabetes. Now, at 16 weeks, you know, we had superiority with a reduction of, remember we talked about a HbA1c earlier, mm-hmm. about that 3-month average. That 3-month average at 16 weeks, at 3 months, reduced by 0.6%. And that's significantly, you know, really powerful data to say, individuals were given a sensor, they were off, they went, Mike. They were not given any education around, you've got to adjust your insulin doses. They had no healthcare professional input for those 16 weeks. And guess what? The CGM supported them to manage their diabetes and reduce it by 0.6%. Now, that's phenomenal.
So they went away and then decided, okay, I'm going to do more exercise, I'm going to eat less rubbish, drink less beer, whatever it might be.
Whatever it might be, they looked at this monitor and they thought, you know what, look at my levels. I'm going to make some self-adjustments. Mm. They went away, and it's significantly important. So, you know, will we hopefully reduce the burden of type 2 diabetes? I really hope we do, you know. But with powerful data like this, it's absolutely phenomenal.
Very positive note, because on the which is what I asked for, so thank you. Because the other side of the coin, actually, is type 2 diabetes costs the NHS, hence all of us, because we all pay for the NHS, a lot of money.
Oh, it does. I mean, you know, we're 60% on complications that we're treating. So actually, we need to think about the beginning of the trajectory of any type of diagnosis. At that beginning trajectory is what's so important. But
I don't
again,
suppose
you've
got any stats at your fingertips about the kind of type of money that NHS currently spends on diabetes.
I haven't got the expenditure in front of me. No, right. Sorry, Mike.
That was an unfair question. I do understand. No, suffice to say, it is absolutely eye-wateringly massive.
It is massive, you know, and this is if I've got anything to say to all the listeners out there. Look, let's be curious. Think about, you know, we've got Abbott, we've got the one step ahead. It's about being curious, about having technology. And if you are a little bit disengaged and you're thinking, absolutely no way, talk to your healthcare professional. We don't bite. I am there to support you. Honestly, Mike, I did a clinic this morning. And in the clinic this morning, I would say two-thirds of my, you know, patients were on a CGM. And we looked at the data together. And the difference has been phenomenal. So if you feel that you want to sort of navigate your way to a little bit more and have a look, I would urge you to maybe visit the website. And the website is, bear with me a second.
Again, you're answering all my questions before I ask them, because my next question was going to be, if people are listening to this and want some, you know, good, solid, factual information, give them some good resources.
Yeah, and I would say, please visit freestyle.abbott. It's as simple as that, freestyle.abbott, and you can pop yourself on the website and navigate through and look at what's available. Okay. And, you know, I think don't pre-anticipate that it's going to be completely overwhelming. And, you know, I always think people living with type 2 diabetes, as with type 1, they feel this sense of burden, you know, and it can become quite low, quite depressing. But actually, we are here to support you. And as a nation, we're here to support you as well. We should all look after each other.
Excellent. What about the NHS website? I imagine that is very good as well, is for lots of things.
Yeah, I mean, it's depending on the area that you live. You've got to have a look and speak to your healthcare professional if there are any other websites that you can maybe have a look at in regards to technology and any other types of technology. But yeah, if you want to think about, you know, let me think about technology in regards to perhaps a continuous glucose monitor, then yes, I would say it's freestyle.abbott.
Excellent. Suki, look, thank you very much indeed for taking the time to chat, because this is important stuff and affects, as we have discussed, an awful lot of people. So many thanks.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
My next guests are one elite athlete and one ex-elite athlete, and their stories remind us of how vital antibiotics can be just for absolutely everyone.
Yeah, I guess I'll start. So
yeah, go ahead, Alice.
My story is quite convoluted. I was born with a severe form of bilateral talipes, more commonly known as club feet. And I had 12 major corrective surgeries by the time I turned, 14 major corrective surgeries by the time that I turned 12. And then later in my life, I ended up having an elective amputation, as well as more surgeries on my arms as a side effect from using crutches constantly. So for me, none of that surgery would have been safe and possible without effective antibiotics, which is why it's something I'm super passionate about. My elective amputation, I had that in 2022, and it's given me a new lease of life. I'm able to, one of the big things was just, you know, walk with an ice cream in the park with my friends in the summer and not have to sit and eat it. So, you know, that whole process, an amputation is a massive surgery and the risk of infection is super high, and antibiotics and access to effective antibiotics played a massive role in that.
Because, I mean, the fact is, if antibiotics don't work or there's a chance they don't work, then all operations actually can be potentially pretty dangerous.
Yeah.
Well, they are dangerous, makes them more dangerous.
Exactly. And I think, you know, having access to them is so, so important. I hate to think in, you know, there are already about 1 million deaths a year because of antibiotic resistance. And over the next few years, that's expected to be, you know, another tens of millions of deaths.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I've got lots of questions about that. But first of all, let's bring Matt in and his story as far as antibiotics is concerned.
excuse me. Yeah, I unfortunately went through a sort of a fairly traumatic family incident with my son, who when he was two, this is 10 years ago, contracted meningitis, bacterial meningitis, and was rushed to hospital and all those, all the nightmares that as parents you wonder and hope that it never happens to your kid, that you've got to roll the glass and see the dots on the arm or see your kid not looking very well and wondering whether it's meningitis. And it actually did happen. Yeah, rushed to hospital within a matter of I'm not even going to say hours. I think it was probably minutes. He was induced into a coma, and as you would imagine, because of the bacterial nature of the meningitis, quite rightly, antibiotics were administered very, very quickly, and having the right ones to react to that absolutely saved his life. There's no question. He was in a coma for 2.5 weeks.
Goodness.
Ongoing treatments, and so both Alice and I have been very much affected over the years by antibiotics. But you know, part of what we're trying to do here, Mike, is not only tell a story, but just to educate ourselves and as many others as we possibly can in the importance of maintaining the effectiveness of antibiotics, because
both of you guys have a positive outcome from the use of antibiotics, but there are sort of problems that are happening now, and even more problems on the horizon potentially with the use of antibiotics. So one of you, either of you, explain what the potential issues are.
Well, I suppose the nature of bacteria is that it will develop resistance to antibiotics over time if those antibiotics are sort of overused, misused, and therefore, you know, the antibiotics that potentially would cure some kind of bacterial infection will just be null and void. Now, unfortunately, even now, the numbers are fairly surprising, into the millions of people who pass away, that just because their body are not reacting to those antibiotics. In 25 years' time, that if we carry on this path, that number is going to be absolutely enormous. Now,
all those people that are passing away now that have antibiotics given to them and they don't work, is that all down to the fact that the bacteria are immune to these antibiotics?
There will probably be quite a few reasons why, but ultimately, the bacteria will build up an immunity itself, and therefore the specific antibiotic that you give for that infection, it won't have an effect. And I'd lay good money that we all have either heard of that some kind of story along those lines, whether it's in my case, I'm thinking of my father, who's, you know, in his getting towards 80 and has been to the doctor numerous times and has been on antibiotics, and lots of them haven't worked. And I'm sure that in and around that process, it's because of how the antibiotics are used in a system, and maybe you should have been using, maybe you shouldn't. But we've all got our own examples of that sort of idea of overuse or misuse, or you know using the wrong antibiotics, maybe even not even finishing the course of antibiotics.
I'm definitely going to ask you about that, but just a moment. If we continue down this route, I think it's important to just ponder many routine procedures, routine surgeries, you know, a new knee, you know, that happens. I don't know how many times that happens in the NHS every day, but a lot. Suddenly, routine things like that are going to become very dangerous.
Well, if you put in those routine surgeries and you think of the cancer treatments, childbirth, all using antibiotics, and they absolutely depend on effective antibiotics, which is, you know, the what you've just mentioned there are key reasons why we've all, the myself and Alice, Becky Allen Addington is with us as well, teaming up with the Fleming Initiative, because the campaign is called Keep Antibiotics in Play. We are passionate, with the support of GSK and their supporting and funding, we're passionate to get this message across that we can all do something just to make that slight bit of difference. We're not asking anybody to become medics or but they don't have to be particularly medically minded. We're all in one of those scenarios more often than not, where we can either, you know, when we're taking our antibiotics, right, finish the course.
Let's look at some of the things that we can do then. And that presumably that's point number one that you just said.
Yeah, point number one is definitely, if you're prescribed antibiotics, finish the course of them. But it can be things as simple as just, you know, having good hygiene, getting your vaccinations, taking your antibiotics as directed. Yeah. And, you know, if you do...
What happens if you don't finish the course? What's the danger there?
Well, if you're not taking the full course, then the bacterial infection isn't being treated properly, which then gives it more room to start building resistance. So it's super important, if we're trying to keep the effectiveness of antibiotics through this campaign and through, you know, up until years to come, then it's really important to finish your course of antibiotics. But yeah, wash your hands, have good hygiene, get your vaccinations. And, you know, if your doctor's saying that you don't need antibiotics, then, you know, don't try and push for them, because we want to try and keep the usage to a minimum. So we're taking them when we really need to.
Do you remember?
Sorry, Mike, just on that, what Alice, just to back up what Alice is saying there. Also, you know, you've got to use them for this is not, you know, just because you've got a cough and a cold doesn't mean that we're going in to use antibiotics. You know, this is a bacterial infection. It's not about the virus. And when someone has some kind of virus, that everybody is going towards antibiotics. You're pushing hard to to your doctor about getting antibiotics. So, you know, it's really important what Alice is saying there about...
They will do no good at all.
taking responsibility, yeah.
I don't know if you remember, a few years ago, 2022, the UK Health Secretary, Theresa Coffey, said she gave leftover antibiotics to a friend. Do you remember that? And I think the whole medical world was sort of in utter disbelief.
Well, I don't remember that, but that it is, I think that's fairly symptomatic of most of people's approach to antibiotics. And there is maybe there is just a slight flippancy, because over the years, it's been very easy to have a prescription of antibiotics. But it's now, with, again, the research that the Fleming Initiative has come to show us, you know, here are the effects of what we're all, not just her that you mentioned, but we're all guilty of it in some way, shape or form.
So do you think... Most people don't really think about antibiotics, or presumably they don't until they need them. But because they don't think about them, they may well just misuse them, use them for the wrong things, not finish the course, this sort of thing.
Absolutely. I think, you know, the research showed that only one in five understood that antibiotics were to treat bacterial infections. So there's a real lack of understanding in the general public. So that's why we're really trying to support this Keep Antibiotics in Play campaign, because it is so important to have this education. And, you know, we can all be part of this movement. We can all help keep antibiotics in play, very literally. So, yeah, and, you know, there's a whole website, fleminginitiative.org/play. People can go and find out more. And it's just, do your research, talk to people about it. If you've got kids, you know, talk to your kids about it. The more understanding we can have as a collective, then the better future we have with the effectiveness of antibiotics.
You know, if people are listening to this and thinking, goodness, you know, this is serious stuff, I would like to find out a little bit more for myself. Can you suggest a couple of good resources that people can have a look at?
Yeah, I mean, as I mentioned, if you want to learn more about bacterial resistance, then you can go to fleminginitiative.org/play. There's loads of information there. And it's just start the conversation, you know. Not a lot of us are scientists, and a lot of us don't initially understand what bacterial infection is and how antibiotics play into that. But you can always start a conversation. You know, it doesn't matter if you feel uneducated about it. Talking about it is the first step. And the more we can just, you know, spread awareness and educate one another and ourselves, I think that's a step in the right direction, even if it is just small things, you know, like, as I said, good hygiene and vaccinations. It really can be really simple to contribute in small ways.
This is definitely a case of knowing a little will make an enormous difference overall. So if people are and they will be listening to this on your wonderful UK Health radio show, even if they went to fleminginitiative.org/play and understood some of the things that we've been talking about today, that in itself is going to make an enormous difference going forward to them, the people around them, and then collectively, you know, we can start bringing those numbers down accordingly.
Okay. I think that's probably a perfect place to leave it. So Matt and Alice, thank you very much indeed for chatting. Thank you very much to my guests on this week's show. They were Suki Banger, diabetic specialist nurse, Matt Dawson, MBE, England rugby player, or ex-England rugby player as scrum half, and Alice Tai, OBE, Paralympian. Thank you to you for listening, and have a healthy week until next week.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Thanks for listening to the Relax Back UK show. Join me, Mike Dilk, again next week for more fascinating interviews and chat. If you're listening to the podcast version, please subscribe, like, and share it with your family and friends. And have a healthy week. Until next week.